Hello and welcome to Different Bits, your Monday night bite of art after the news. In the studio with me tonight is Amy Franceschini, a pioneer of multidisciplinary arts. She is the founder of Future Farmers, a new media collaborative dedicated to expressing environmental and community interests. She's also an educator teaching new media classes at both San Francisco Art Institute and Stanford. So, welcome, Amy.
Thanks.
Shortly, Jonathan Muser will also be joining us on the telephone. We're just going to wait for his phone call, and then we will get started. So stay tuned, and we'll be with Amy shortly. So we are going to get started. Amy is the founder of Future Farmers. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and Future Farmers in particular, your organization?
Sure. Future Farmers actually started in 1995, which at that time I was researching the area where I grew up, which was the San Joaquin Valley of California, which is essentially the breadbasket for the world in terms of food. And we export loads and loads of different fruits and vegetables to many parts of the world. This might be Jonathan.
So that was Jonathan calling in. You can continue if you want to finish with what you're saying.
And so at that time, I was just kind of looking at that area and the changing landscape socially, politically, economically, because in 1995 was just the beginning of the sort of technological boom that was happening in the Bay Area, and a lot of people were moving here, impacting the environment. A lot of the farms in the San Joaquin Valley were being affected by that, in that a lot of bedroom communities were being built because people needed to commute from the San Joaquin Valley to San Jose and to the Bay Area. And what that was doing was actually giving farmers the opportunity to not farm their land at a time when it was very hard to farm there because prices of food were very low. But a lot of farmers were leasing their water rights to these bedroom communities, which is something I became interested in. So a lot of the land was sitting fallow, and not farmed so that the water could be sent to bedroom communities. So at that time in 95, I was sort of interested in current farming practice and possible farming practices of the future and what's going to happen to this area. So I started making work under this name, Future Farmers.
Great. Thank you so much. And now, Jonathan, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, great. So we're joined by Jonathan Muser on the telephone. So Jonathan, Amy was just explaining her organization, Future Farmers. Can you tell us a little bit about your work, your research in hydrogen production?
Well, I actually got interested in hydrogen production in 2000, the method for sulfur-deprived hydrogen production in Hawaii. That was discovered. And there's a lot of reasons that it's, you know, really awesome technology. But it wasn't until 2003 that I got a chance to work at the National Renewable Energy Lab on a project related to hydrogen production. And that really got me inspired to work on, to continue working on it.
So can you tell us exactly what working in hydrogen production means exactly?
Okay. Well, essentially, I don't know how I should really introduce it. Essentially, a lot of organisms produce hydrogen gas as a metabolic byproduct. A few organisms have actually integrated this really ancient metabolism into photosynthesis. They actually couple the harvesting of solar light into the production of hydrogen gas as a direct byproduct. And so the benefits are that you're connecting splitting of water, production of oxygen and hydrogen, and biomass in a completely clean cycle. It's infinitely regenerative. So the benefit of applying that technology, you know, on a global scale to all of our energy needs could have, you know, really great implications.
Okay. Here's a question for the two of you. Can you tell us about your collaborative work, DIY Algal Hydrogen Bioreactor? Open.
Maybe I'll start. I was interested in trying to find different types of energy that could be produced by the people, and finding a way that people wouldn't have to depend on large corporations to produce energy. And I was looking at different types of kind of biodiesel, and I was interested in hydrogen. And I'd read a lot about hydrogen fuel cells, and I didn't really know a lot about it. So I started looking on the internet, and I found out that some scientists had been harvesting hydrogen from algae. And I wrote one of the scientists, Michael Siebert, who was very responsive but very busy writing grants to get money for research, and he told me about Jonathan, who was at UC Davis. And I asked Jonathan if there was any possibility that he would want to collaborate on making a backyard model so that people could have the power to create their own energy, and with the goal of creating a sort of system where people could have them in their backyards and neighborhoods could be networked so that they could collectively produce hydrogen and use that in whatever form they could to fuel their homes and their cars, etc. So, Jonathan, that's kind of what I presented with you with, I think.
But yeah, so basically, when Amy had contacted me, I've been looking for an opportunity to build a reactor that could be out of, you know, materials that are found easily obtained. I had a lot of ideas, but was also kind of limited to the idea of needing to build something that was completely, you know, perfect. You know, there's not a perfection that you can actually do it. And Amy was really a great inspiration by, you know, giving me the opportunity to have a place to show it and to actually, you know, have someone who's actually motivated to motivate me to produce something, you know, and you just take that leap of faith.
So Amy was saying that she called you up and was talking about this backyard, you know, distributed model. What did you think of that when she said that?
I think that's really the ultimate goal of this research. I mean, what's really great is that, essentially we're all tied to that need to get energy, and whether in the form of chemical bonds and driving our vehicles, or in Colorado here, where I live now, it's mostly coal, chemical bonds and coal for our electricity, 80% of our energy. And it's the biggest business right now, and the fewest people own it. And so by taking the incident light, the energy that's hitting our homes every day, and converting that into a usable form, and completely, dismantling that whole social economic energy pyramid that exists now, it has huge implications, I think. And I think that algae really has the ability to do that, actually.
Maybe.
Just a matter of doing it.
I don't know. Maybe I can lead you into talking about some other aspects of this, but I think after we presented the backyard model at University of the Pacific in Stockton, and Jonathan came and he basically kind of in a performative style set up the bioreactor and did a presentation about his research. But one thing that became interesting to me after talking to Jonathan was the idea of how much territory suburban houses consume. And he was talking about the sort of industrial model of this, where they would need to line several hundreds of acres of land with sort of intestinal tracts, or I'm not exactly sure, Jonathan, you can jump in, but to harvest massive amounts of hydrogen. And so my sort of utopian fantasy was like, oh, can't we use the rooftops of suburban houses and sort of empower these people? I don't know if that's a possibility. Is that a possibility, Jonathan?
Yeah, and what's really incredible is a man named John Turner, who works at NREL, did some calculations and found that if you could have a system of producing hydrogen that's 10% efficient, it'd only take 100 miles by 100 miles, so 100,000 square miles of land to provide all of our electrical needs in the United States. And actually, Clamdomonas, the species we work with, the estimated highest level of efficiency that we're hoping to get is 10%. And that's, I think, really doable over time. And that is actually less than a quarter of the current land that's being covered by just roads and highways on the United States right now. And it's actually, if you were to look at it on a map, there's a picture in this paper, it's really just a small block in the middle of Nevada. It really isn't that much when you consider the amount of built space in the United States right now.
Can you maybe talk about or provide a little bit of clarity of where the United States stands right now in funding hydrogen research and the sort of political implications of that?
Well, I think I looked at the DOE as one of the primary funders of this research, photobiological research, and it's really the holy grail of energy production, produced a usable fuel directly from solar energy, with no byproducts, no hazardous byproducts. And unfortunately, in 2003, there was equivalent funding for just coal research to all of the different technologies being studied at the National Renewable Energy Lab. Their budget was equivalent to just one thing, and they studied maybe 30 different technologies, maybe more. So it really is kind of grossly underfunded when you consider the potential for this technology, and also the need.
Okay. And do you know anything about the plan for California in particular? There's been some talk about California being the first or the foremost state of hydrogen research and electric cars and hydrogen fuel cell cars.
I think one thing that's really important to understand is that hydrogen is an energy carrier. It's really not a source of energy. Most of the energy on Earth comes directly from the sun, but different groups are vying for that opportunity to produce the hydrogen. And not all the options are clean. Most of the options are not clean. Two primary examples I can think of are nuclear and coal. And nuclear and coal, one of the benefits of nuclear coal is that you can really localize it. And you can have one person who owns it, one person who makes a lot of money. Not everyone's going to have coal in their backyard. Everyone has solar.
Right. I don't know if you have questions, but I think one thing that was really interesting about meeting Jonathan is I think we were both equally inspired. I don't know a whole lot about this kind of science he's researching, and so just the little bit he educated me sparked sort of these utopian ideas and architectural and art projects. And then in the sense that I wasn't a laboratory expecting, like, solid data, he was more inspired to, like, create a model that maybe wasn't completely up to the top efficiency. Mm-hmm. But I think the interesting thing about Jonathan is that, like, he lives his life completely as sustainable as possible and has a million ideas of other sort of applications of his work that seem more artistic to me. And maybe you want to talk about some of your fantasy projects, Jonathan. I don't know if you have a list or
which one? I mean,
the red, maybe the the mutant redwood, or I don't know.
Yeah, because it's interesting. I do have a lot of different ideas. There's so many different ways. I mean, one of the best ways I think to live more sustainably is just cutting back. It's just so easy. It really isn't that much harder. A lot of the current systems that we live in, I think, can be modified a lot more intelligently. For instance, the nitrogen that we excrete just goes right back into the air through current waste treatment processes. And we actually use a lot of fossil fuels to get the nitrogen out of the air into a usable form for plants. It's the Klaus-Haber synthesis, actually. And yet we throw it all away when we urinate. And There's a system devised that I think could be improved. You can concentrate urea and use it as a clean fertilizer without any worry of pathogens whatsoever, and mitigate all the fossil fuels used for that.
And what are you currently trying to do with a piece of wood?
Oh. What were you saying? With the urea concentrator?
The mushrooms.
Oh, the mushrooms. Oh, yeah. Well, I'm actually really interested in mycology. What's really interesting about them is they can break down cellulose, which is, you know, it's a carbohydrate. It's a series of thousands of sugars. But we don't have the enzymes to break it down and yield those sugars, whereas the fungal kingdoms can. And so it's amazing that you can convert a waste product, you know, chips of wood, into a high-protein food. And I've been doing it at home and working lately on developing home methods.
What are you doing exactly?
Growing mushrooms at home from waste products, essentially.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, currently I'm getting a few pounds a week. I think it's about 10 to 20% of my protein.
Of shiitake mushrooms.
That's great. Sounds good. Invite us over for dinner sometime.
Yeah, definitely. I found some new strains, like lion's mane and maitake. It's really incredible. I mean, it's hard to really talk about, you know, don't convert a wood product, this waste, directly into, like, these great mushrooms you can just fry up and consume. And it really is something that anyone with a microwave can do.
Impressive.
So, in terms of both the algae and the mushroom production, one of the hardest things about this kind of thing is actually you need to establish a monoculture. So either just one mushroom in a bag or just one big tank of algae. And so that would, and if you want to use natural waters, that implies cleaning those waters. And often that's done by heat, which is extremely energy intensive. Recently I've been experimenting with a chemical called peracetic acid, the mixture of hydrogen peroxide acetate, and actually breaks down into completely non-hazardous byproducts in 14 minutes. And so a home user could have their own hydrogen pond and not have to use all the energy to heat up the water in the hydrogen pond.
So how close are we to algal hydrogen production on a somewhat massive scale or on a sustainable kind of scale?
Well, that's a really hard question to answer. I don't think I can answer it accurately because there's so many things we're doing right now. Just to give you an idea of the scope of the projects that we're involved in, currently, up to 7,000 culturable green algae. There are 30 species that are known to produce hydrogen gas. These 30 species have been found out of 90 or so tested, not much more than that, of these 7,000 culturable species. But we're, you know, still left looking at the other, you know, 6,900 species and more and beyond for, different hydrogen production pathways, different efficiencies, different substrates. And it's not only the green algae that produce hydrogen. There's the diatoms, the yellow green algae, and so many others. And also the cyanobacteria, actually, which could be the origin of this pathway. And they also photoproduce hydrogen gas. So, yeah, we've been looking at one species because it's a model organism. It's genome scale. The metabolic pathways have been really well studied. But there's a whole world, really, to explore in this field, and we're really at the tip of the iceberg.
What do you feel is your biggest hurdle?
Biggest hurdle?
Yeah.
I really think just how many hands we have on the project. I think, you know, the more money, the more funding we have, the more people we can have doing it. I don't think it's a matter of lack of technology, because I think the technology to find this stuff out is already there. It's just a matter of having the people on the project.
So for me, the aspect of your collaboration that I found the most appealing was the DIY aspect of it, was the idea of having this backyard model that I looked at, you know, on the website, didn't see it in person, but I looked at it on the website and felt like, oh, wow, that looks like something I could really make, you know, in my room, in my yard, at home. Do you feel like that's true? Like the model that you guys came up with could really be created by me in my backyard? And if so, do you want to talk a little bit about the steps required in doing that?
Amy, do you want to?
I think you have to tell, you have to describe the steps. I think my initial interest was working with Jonathan to see if it is possible, and no one had ever made one at all that was possible. I mean, there hadn't been one yet, and so this was an experiment for Jonathan to try to see if it would work, and I don't think it's at the point where Heather or myself could do it on our own. Do you think it is, Jonathan?
Well, there's a couple of hurdles that had to be overcome in this particular project. One is that typically hydrogen production in the lab is induced by growing the cells up in all their healthy nutrients and then spinning them down in a centrifuge and separating them from that nutrient medium and putting in a new medium that has no sulfur. And that sulfur minus medium induces hydrogen production. In this model, we tried something new on a paper that had just been published, and that was, that was actually diluting the medium with the sulfur into a non-sulfur medium, about 1 to 10. And so that alone was a trick. The other problem I ran into was sterilizing that large volume of water. And so we actually used a 55-gallon drum in the backyard and made a fire, put the drum on a fire, and through steam, we'd be able to steam the large volume of water, thereby sterilize it. But overall, that design is basically just proof of concept that you could make hydrogen gas. But I wouldn't say that it's enough from that volume of the reactor to actually be usable, per se.
Is it enough to, say, inflate a balloon?
Yeah, definitely enough to inflate a balloon. But in terms of electrical output, you wanted to convert that hydrogen, you wouldn't be able to do a whole lot.
So how much algae would you say it takes to produce enough hydrogen in your backyard model just to inflate like a normal balloon?
Well, inflating a balloon in terms of hydrogen and ambient pressure really isn't that much, because actually the hydrogen you would burn in a hydrogen car, for instance, is at 5,000 PCI, or PSI, pounds per square inch. If I remember correctly, one atmosphere is about 14.7 PSI. So we're talking about multiple, a thousand times, right? Not thousand, roughly a couple hundred times the atmospheres. So if you have that balloon compressed, 200 times smaller, it'd be about the amount that you have to burn in your car. Essentially. So not that you would need to burn in a car. Actually, I was lucky enough to ride down to the National Hydrogen Association meeting with some folks from UC Davis that do a lot of research on hydrogen vehicles. We crunch the numbers, and it looked like if you had enough roof space to row two panels of about 40 feet by 40 feet, then with the current technology, you could drive your car 20,000 miles a year.
That's good.
Yeah, definitely.
And cars, the thing is a car is an interesting unit of energy, car's miles, because a house uses much less energy than a car. So if you're still on your bike, you probably use much smaller panels to just power your fluorescent light bulbs and your basic appliances in the home.
So I'm curious to hear from you, John, how the experience of working with Amy as an artist, how that was for you as a scientist?
I could just say that basically she's a catalyst, because it's kind of a scientific way of looking at things. I had all this energy, and I had a passion, but I didn't have the instigation to actually do it, to make it happen. And I think Amy really provided that energy for me to get me over that and to get me doing this. And I really appreciate it. I probably would never, until now.
I think it was a symbiotic relationship. No pun intended.
What were your artistic goals with this piece? And do you feel like you accomplished what you were looking to?
Me? I think I definitely accomplished what I was looking for, and I think it kind of speaks to the work that I do, in that I'm always more interested in sort of the process and the making of and the end product. somehow is always not so interesting as the process. It's because it's over. It's like once you know what you're doing, that's kind of the end. And someone very great named Jaron Lanier said, art is like science, where you should be on the edge of the sea of the unknown. You're on this island of knowledge that's been built up over years and years. And that if you know what you're doing as a scientist, your job's over. But I think what I was excited about when I found out that there were scientists working in this harvesting of hydrogen from algae was illustrating it to the public through a model. And that's basically what Jonathan did. It wasn't producing loads and loads of hydrogen, but it was a step-by-step illustration of how the process works in a visual display, and accompanying that with a presentation from his work inside the lab. And I think another thing that was interesting is that in the lab, it's kind of this place that we all think about, okay, they're doing this research on this stuff, but we never get to actually see what they're doing. And I think a lot of times when you go to a lab, they're using these chemicals to purify the water, or, you know, very expensive chemicals to break things down. And it was interesting to see Jonathan try to do it with things that we have in our backyard. Mm-hmm. And I think the illustration of that was basically what I was after, and not so much like if it was going to power my house or somebody else's mm-hmm. house.
I think that one thing that was just so powerful about this project too for me is that the amount that I learned when doing it. You know, the act of, you know, struggling through this stuff and making it work and trying to find a way to do it rather than just trying to work through it as a thought experiment, actually do it and produce something that's physical. I learned a lot. And it's actually, there's so many changes I'm planning on the at home. And I'd like to make further models and make further improvements and just keep on doing it until it's applicable technology.
So I have two more algae questions here. First of all, how does algal hydrogen production compare to, you know, like electrolysis hydrogen production in terms of efficiency, practicality?
It depends on where you define the life cycle. So if we're assuming that we're going to reach 10% efficiency, it's approximately equivalent, you know, when you set them up side by side. And the amount of hydrogen you get per amount of light, square footage of light. But if you include the factory for producing the solar panels and the electrolysis machine, and all that energy, suddenly, you know, all your thermodynamics change. Also, solar panels are actually, you know, semiconductors, and essentially they're hazardous waste when you're done with them. And although they have a long lifespan, you know, up to, what, 40 years, they can get, you know, 10, 14% efficiency. It turns out that if when you're done with them, they're not really an infinitely regenerative technical nutrient. So whereas the algae, you can compost it, you can run it right back into the nature.
Bravo. Yeah, that's great. Actually, could you talk a little bit more about the solar panels as waste? I haven't really heard much about that.
Yeah, it's interesting. People get really surprised when you ask them what you do with them when you're done. Because people think of, you know, 40 years, 50 years of a lifetime as being so long. And as a biologist, I don't really think that is very long at all.
Mm-hmm.
I know we want to run out of silicon, but unfortunately there's a lot of heavy metals that are in solar panels that aren't exactly easy to extract back out. In fact, mm-hmm. I don't know if there are any methods. I haven't been able to find any to extract those metals like palladium back out of the panels.
And so there, let's see, I'm trying to think of where to go next with this. Oh, let me just give a quick reminder to our listeners. You're listening to Enemy Combatant Radio, streaming live on enemycombatantradio.net. This is Indie Media San Francisco's live streaming web station. If you would like to call into the studio, we only have one phone and Jonathan's on it, but after Jonathan gets off the phone number is 415-864-1006. And I guess I'd like to ask both of you how you see this hydrogen model fitting into a larger picture of sustainable energy production in the United States, especially in light, you know, it seems like more and more recently, every time I read the news, I hear another report about climate change and global warming and how we're seeing increasing evidence of this and need to come up with a solution quickly, like extremely quickly. And so I'm wondering how you see this maybe fitting into a solution.
Jonathan, you want to talk about that?
Well, more than just producing energy, there's some other opportunities in the biological hydrogen production. And one is in eutrophication, and that's the runoff of nitrogen from farmland. And it apparently there's a kill radius outside of the Mississippi River from the nitrogen runoff. And the whole Mississippi is just a mess. And one real great thing about the biological hydrogen production is when you burn hydrogen gas, you're also provided with perfectly clean water. And so by pulling this nitrogen out and forming proteins and biomass, that biomass can then be used to potentially make ethanol as a fuel or be rolled back into the fields and thereby clean the water from some of these places. But in terms of the problems with global warming, one of the nice things about this is in the short term, it will actually fix carbon to produce sugars and effectively decrease the amount of carbon dioxide. But of course, the most biological process is the carbon's broken down. Either you make other products, methane, carbon dioxide. But in the overall scheme of things, no carbon would be added to the atmosphere, completely carbon neutral.
I don't really have an answer for you, but I think it's going to take a large shift for our government to start funding this kind of research. And I know that our project is just a small little voice in this large picture, but I hope that the work that Jonathan's doing and what I'm trying to do will be somewhat helpful.
If we get enough small voices.
Yeah. But I surely have a lot of hope in this research, and I can't see any reason why we shouldn't be funding it. I think we're funding a lot of other things that aren't worthy. So, fund hydrogen research.
You know, my utopian vision for it is that basically to make it dirt cheap, and so that anyone can do it. So that there's really no cost question whether people would or wouldn't. No one would think to, you know, to burn fossil fuels because it's just so much more expensive. I think that that's kind of the level that we're at as a country, that if you want something to dominate, you just make it cheaper and easier and more efficient.
Yeah.
I think if I was to, you know, just dream about the possibilities, it would be really great to have a cooperative system in which, you know, it wouldn't cost much to buy in. Someone could come install a system on your roof and you could start receiving the benefits of it immediately. And they're going to have excess to actually support the co-op for further installations and get the technology on more homes.
Can we look to any future collaborations between the two of you? Anything coming up?
I hope so.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised.
Anything in the works you want to share? Or?
They're brewing.
Fair enough. And where can people go for more information on the hydrogen production and DIY style hydrogen production stuff in general?
Jonathan, do you have any pointers where people can just
websites or
learn more about the process?
Well, there would be, you know, eventually maybe stuff on the blog. I don't know, what do you think, Amy?
Sure. I mean, that's already a little bit of stuff, but that would be a good impetus for us.
It's pretty simple. It's remediate.blogspot.com.
Remediate.blogspot.com.
.com.
Yep.
Is that other site, Amy, up? Or is it not really officially yet?
Which one? The one with the pictures? Of the project?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's officially up. That's on futurefarmers.com/survey, and then you can just navigate to DYI algal hygiene bioreactor.
Yes, that's where I saw the project myself. Well, Jonathan, I'm going to let you get off the phone before you run up a huge phone bill here. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, no, thanks for calling in, and maybe we'll talk to you again in the future. Bye. Bye, Jonathan. Okay. So now, listeners, if you would like to call in, that number again was 415-864-1006. And let's see, should we arrange ourselves here in the studio, or are you pretty comfortable? Or?
I'm okay.
Okay. So let me just orient myself for a second. So, Amy, ecology and alternative energy in particular seems to be a prevalent theme in your visual works. In addition to DIY hydrogen installation, I was thinking of solar music boxes, photosynthesis robot, offshoots, botanical game bot, except... Oh. He hadn't quite left. Amy, could you talk about the importance of ecology in your work and how it connects to your ideas about art?
I think I'm interested in systems in general, and I think I've always looked to natural systems for inspiration. And sort of the first thing that I know this is not a project that you mentioned, but I think one of the first projects that I was sort of forced into putting, or sort of the one part of research that I was sort of forced into putting a form around was a project I did at Yerba Buena, which was about migratory birds in the San Joaquin Valley and the Bay Area, and how they were being impacted by influxes of population and growth, and that how that endangered the natural environment. And mostly, I was looking at the wetlands around San Francisco Bay Area, and a lot of the migratory birds would return year after year, and the territory where they would return to would be disrupted somehow, either a parking lot or industrial waste. And they didn't know how to react to that because they're so in tune to their rituals, their natural ritual, that they don't adapt immediately. And that I started researching that, and I found that the same thing was happening in Canada with the return of the Canadian geese. They would return and there'd be a suburban housing complex, and humans started taking on the responsibility of meeting up with them before they would land in these sort of hang gliders that looked like birds and redirect their flight patterns to non-endangered areas.
Wow.
And I think PBS did a special about it. And peregrine falcons were roosting on the Oracle building in Silicon Valley and adapting to them as cliffs instead of, I mean, they were building sides of buildings, but they were kind of roosting as if they were cliffs, and Oracle embodied this by, or kind of paid homage to this by putting a webcam on their website, and you could look at the peregrine falcons roosting on their building. But I just sort of found this interest within this of this sort of human, there in San Francisco specifically, there was this need for humans to migrate in their cars in and out of the city to work, from the bedroom communities in San Joaquin Valley to San Francisco. So there was this sort of micro migration going on, but then this macro migration of the birds that were colliding. So that was sort of my first interest in these conflicting rituals of humans and nature, seeing them as sort of the same system, but not really living in harmony. So that sort of sprang me into the work I'm doing now. I did a project about the migratory birds at Bay Area now, a piece called Holding Patterns, which took all the traffic data from the city on a daily basis and interpolated that into a robotic arm that would either expand or contract during the different peak periods. And there was a series of five lamps that expanded and contracted, and inside was a bird, a little robotic bird, that when it expanded would have room to fly. And the offshoots piece you mentioned was a recent piece, which I had been doing a lot of online community tools, trying to figure out a way to get people to communicate online and visualize those interactions. And when I was in grad school at Stanford, I was asked to do a piece about my work, but don't use any of the normal means or methods that I normally use. And I was trying to figure out, like, okay, should I paint something? Should I do video? What should I do? And I was like, what do I do? Okay, I create communities for or I create tools for people to create community, but I never meet those people that I create the tools for. And that's one thing that I'm missing. So I did a project where I lived in Noe Valley at the time, and my neighborhood had become really gentrified and very unneighborly. I'd lived there for 10 years, and it was during the dot-com boom. Everybody became really rich, and they would get really mad if you parked an inch in their driveway, and they would tow you, and they never said hi. They just, like, came in and out, but I was also noticing that all their backyards were flourishing, and on the weekends, they'd have gardeners and plants and hot tubs, and I was like, okay, this is a symbol of wealth in this neighborhood. So I decided that I wanted to somehow distribute the wealth of these backyards to other people in other neighborhoods, as a sort of portrait of this community that I lived in. So for that project, I went to the neighbors' doors and knocked on the doors, and I was immediately like greeted by this this like, who are you? What do you want? And I was like, hi, I'm your neighbor. I've been your neighbor for 10 years. I'm doing this project, da da da. And then they didn't give me any light until I said I'm a student at Stanford, and then they were like, oh, and they like kind of rolled the red carpet out and let me in their backyard and told me all about their plants and their herbs and the grape plants and la la la, and were very generous with giving offshoots of their plants for me to distribute to other people.
What's an offshoot?
An offshoot is you just break off a piece of a plant. Usually a succulent is the best plant to have an offshoot come from, because you can just stick it in the dirt and it'll grow without very much care. So I did ask for mainly succulent offshoots, but people would offer me their herbs, and one person offered me wine from their grapes in their backyard. So I went to 6 neighbors for the first iteration of the project, actually 9 neighbors, and packaged each of their offshoots in these bank bags that I had. From scrap. They were just these bank bags that said like 50 cents Citibank or something for coins, and put dirt in them in a pot and care instructions, and labeled the species and the name of the plant and the name of the donor if they wanted to be public, and their email address. And I handed them out to everybody in my class at Stanford. But then I did it on a larger scale at the Exploratorium for first Wednesdays or third Wednesdays. And the Exploratorium sent out to their whole list a request for offshoots, and I received mounds and mounds of offshoots the night of the opening. And each person had tagged them and given their email address. And so for the Exploratorium, I set up a potting shed, a library with some books about community, neighborhood gardening projects, guerrilla gardening, sustainable systems. I served tea with some of the herbs that were donated. And I used this sort of interface of handing out the plants as a way to talk about this idea of like a community and systems of exchange. And people are so open, especially because they're getting something for free from a stranger that they might possibly become connected to. And some people did become connected. They would send pictures to the people of the plant where they had planted it. So I do have some pictures of like where it originated from and where it ended up. But
that's great. Can you talk a little bit more about some of the other ideas you mentioned, like the guerrilla gardening and that kind of thing?
I haven't actually instigated any guerrilla gardening tactics, but I'm definitely interested in that. I'm working with a group of artists right now, and we just started a website which hasn't launched. It's launching March 1st, called Free Soil. And one of the artists is from Denmark. His name is Nis Romer, and we met in Norway, and we're kind of talking about guerrilla gardening projects. And we actually ended up collaborating, he and my husband Stein Skiffeliers and Joni Taylor from Berlin. We did a project in a park in a small village in Norway, and we created a game for the public to play, to foster discussion about the political atmosphere of this specific island where we were. And it was very successful. Many local people came and got very excited about what we were doing. And so now we're kind of formed a collective and have some things in brewing, but I haven't done any guerrilla gardening projects. But I went to see Bob Kennard, who is a gardener for Chez Panisse. And he's up north somewhere, but he's this sort of radical character. But he said the most subversive thing you can do is save seeds. And that's always kind of resonated with me because of all the genetically modified food. We need to save our seeds. So if there's one thing everybody can do, is save the seeds from their plants in the backyard and create your own little library for that time when there won't be any more heirloom seeds.
Yeah, I mean, that's been a gigantic movement, like in India and stuff, too.
Yeah.
Trying to get away from some of the genetic modifications. Maybe to continue with the community building theme a little bit, that's what sort of one of the aspects that I've found most appealing in just looking through the projects on your survey site and that kind of thing, just how you have been able to, you know, really take your art and put it in the public sphere and, you know, use art as a way of getting people together, of, you know, instead of, we sort of think of, or at least I think of traditional gallery art as distancing people and isolating people and sort of focusing very much on the individual. And I feel like a lot of your work has very effectively just removed that notion completely, you know, and really brought people together instead of pushing them further back into themselves. Could you talk maybe a little bit about just your thoughts about community building and in particular in relation to art?
Yeah, I think definitely I'm more interested in making art that allows the audience to become an active participant or actually an author. I read about that term, activating the audience and making them an author, from Hans Hacke, who's one of my favorite artists. And I think I'll just talk about maybe an example of his work because it illustrates the idea a lot.
Perfect.
But I just think that a lot of times, especially when I was doing work inside the gallery, I would work hours and hours and sometimes with lots of people helping to produce an object or a piece that would sit in a gallery. And I would go into the gallery sometimes and I would just feel like there was no life left to it. And so I kind of stopped making this object art and was trying to foster another type of art making where people who come to the gallery can be involved, or that it doesn't have to exist in any particular space, that it could exist anywhere. But I think I am most interested in creating templates where people kind of fill in the content. And I think I've been most comfortable doing that online just because it's been something that I actually was asked to do for corporations in the beginning. So I was hired to do community tools for corporate clients. And from that, I just kind of learned the language of this sort of template. But I think the project that it really has inspired me the most is a piece that Hans Hacke did in Berlin for the Reichstag, which is kind of the city hall of Berlin. And he proposed to change some of the text on the top of the building. And I don't know German well enough to translate it, but it basically said, to the German people. But it used a word named Volk, which had kind of a negative connotation in Germany. And he wanted to change the saying to say, to the population of Germany. And what he did is he proposed to have this garden in the entryway and have these words in the Gothic font that was on the front of the building, but have them in these large fluorescent letters and have soil all around that, around these letters, but the soil would be provided by one person, one politician from each constituency in Germany. So he would ask each one to bring a 100-pound bag of soil from their constituency to Berlin and pour it in this container. It was opposed extremely.
Who was it opposed by?
Many people, mostly right-wing religious groups, but it was... It became this really important event, and all the people in the parliament actually came to the meeting to vote for or against it. And usually only like a certain small population showed up for these kind of public art meetings. And it got on national television, and basically it passed, I think, by a very small percentage, like 2%, or it passed by two votes. And one woman was One reason one woman didn't want to do the project is she thought she would look ridiculous carrying a 100-pound bag of soil into the Reichstag. And then you see her on national TV professing this, and then you see her during the inauguration of the project with this 100-pound bag of soil pouring it into this big nice. Box. But it's become really beautiful because it's grown into this very communal community garden. Some people brought pot plants, and pot seeds were in the soil, and there's pot plants, there's different flowers. There's a webcam on it all the time, so you can see it. But I just think like that piece really embodies a large population, a public voice, and also it involves the politicians of a city to become involved and a voice for that entire country. So that's sort of the mega project that I always look up to.
Oh, geez, we've already run out of time.
Okay.
But that's okay. We're only on the internet and no one's following us up, so we can keep going. I just had a few more questions.
Okay.
In particular, I wanted to ask you about how you see your physical and your virtual works interconnecting or colliding now or in the future.
I think they always inform each other. Like, I'm definitely more affluent or comfortable with digital media. It's just, like, I'm very comfortable with those tools. It's something I've just become accustomed to using. And I'm also much more engaged in the language of that media just because it's so available to me, and I kind of know how to navigate my way through it. And the physical aspects come kind of from my previous work when I was kind of younger building sculptural elements. And when I'm working in digital media, I miss the physical aspects. And when I'm working in physical, I miss the immediacy of the digital world. So they always kind of interweave, and it's not ever pre-planned. It's like more about, I kind of think of the idea first, and if they find a way of merging, which they always do, then it happens like that. Mm-hmm.
So what are you working on right now? What can we look forward to from you?
Right now I'm working on a collaboration with an entomologist at UC Davis, and it's a project that will open April 25th at the Nelson Gallery at UC Davis. Rennie Pritikin, who was the former curator of Yerba Buena, is now curator there, and he's doing a series of short shows that are kind of risky for him because the Nelson has been kind of conservative museum, and so he's a new curator trying to inform them about
up a bit.
More risky projects. So he just asked me to do something in this room, but I had to work with somebody on campus. And so I'm working with Arthur Shapiro, who's been studying butterflies for 33 years in California. And I went to him because I had read a lot about butterflies as bioindicators of global change. And he doesn't really agree with me on that, but he's agreed to work with me in some way and find a meeting of our worlds. And so
interesting.
Right now I've just been spending a lot of time with him going to monitoring stations and learning about his process and how he monitors the different butterflies and species and studies their evolutionary patterns. And they use a lot of digital media as well. They have to feed in all the data that they get and create data sets and look at different use different algorithms to view that data, which is kind of what we do online. So we might find a way to merge those two things. Or we might do something more physical. I'm not sure yet. And then I'm just working together with, sorry.
Oh no, I'm trying not to cough.
I'm working together with Stain Skiffelers and Nis Romer and Joni Taylor on this collective Free Soil, which will be
very cool.
free-soil.org.
To ask you a bit more about the Butterfly Project, you mentioned that there was a point of contention. I'm curious how, in working together, if you've influenced each other's ideas or disagreement on the subject, or.
I think Arthur Shapiro is pretty sure of what he's doing. He's been monitoring 9 stations across California for 33 years. He's outside 265 days of the year looking at the same thing. So I think he's pretty sure about what he's doing and pretty convinced that the life of a butterfly is about sex. He has seen variances in population, which some scientists think is because of global change. The one major thing that he's seen over the 33 years is that the migratory patterns have changed and that they aren't coming out as early as they used to come out. So there's been about, I'm not exactly, like a 3-week variance over the 33 years, which is kind of extreme.
Yeah.
And there's been many species lost, but that's the only indicators he's mentioned.
And what other indicators have you heard about?
Pretty much that a lot of the, in Britain, especially because they're very funded for studying entomology or butterflies, they've found that the, because of the warming of the globe, a lot of the butterflies have come south. I mean, actually they've gone north. And that's just, they figure that that's an indicator of global change.
Definitely. Well, that's great. So is there anything else you wanted to mention before we end today's show?
I want to say thank you. It's really great what you're doing here.
Thanks for coming in so much. All right. Well, thank you all for listening. And this has been Different Bits on Enemy Combatant Radio, streaming on enemycombatantradio.net, indiebay.org's local radio station here in San Francisco. Stay tuned, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.